That side, if you guys would just move over to this side, we don't have to keep turning.
That's right. But then we'll have to look over there, so we're, you know.
Alright. Mine can turn.
Here, do you want that?
My crib glasses?
You want that?
It's good. You got my crib glasses, too?
You know what? Keith from Dynamite left these glasses, so we're gonna take the highest bid. You may have to compare prescriptions, but... thanks for coming, everybody. I'm Dirk Wood. I'm the marketing guy at IDW. To my right, as I mentioned, is the amazing Walter Simonson. To my left, the incredible James Tinney in the fourth. To his left, our president, the equally incredible Greg Goldstein. And we've got a few things to talk about up here, and then hopefully have time for lots of Q&A, even though I took care of some of that the last few minutes. But anyway, thanks for coming. And if you can see the art, which I hope you can, I think the first thing we're going to talk about is Ragnarok by the aforementioned.
Okay. I'll be able to leave, and then we're done here.
By the way, you know what? If you're back soon,
yep.
You are more than welcome to
do
that. We can talk some Ragnarok. You can take a few questions if you want.
All right. I might do that.
And then we'll heckle you all the way out.
Then that'll be fine. Go find some more motion.
Yeah.
No, but seriously.
Derek, push the mic a little bit closer to Walter.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh,
there we go. See how that
goes. All
right.
Well.
I'll just lean in.
There we go.
That'll be good.
That's
going to
be
good. Well, no kidding.
Well, man. All right. Fire it up.
All right. Let's see. Oh, that's a nice angle.
Wow.
The book actually does come at that angle.
It's so powerful. You have to read it cockeyed like that.
Or if you look it over there, it should be more relative.
Well, that's funny. Right. Right.
Anyway, so Ragnarok, for those of you who don't know, is a book we've been publishing with Walter for, you know, for about a year. There's six great issues out. No one can talk about this book better than you can. So I'm worried about that, I think.
Oh, I think so. Actually, Walter casts a hypnotic spell, so you all go out and buy multiple copies when he's done. So
well, if only that were true.
do you want to talk a little bit about the beginnings
all
of
right.
Ragnarok?
What Ragnarok is, I've told this story about 17 years ago. Scott Dinberg, who's an editor at IDW, called me up and asked me out of the blue if I'd want to do a creator-owned Norse mythology-themed comic book. At the time, for Wildstorm, which is where Scott was working, he was the editor-in-chief of Wildstorm. A couple of companies later, Scott was IDW, and it was 15 years later. And I had an idea for the comic. I had a lot of work to do before that, so I had an idea. I called Scott up and said, remember that talk we had 15 years ago about doing a book on Norse myths? And that eventually, that became Ragnarok. That's where that ended up. The gist of the book simply is that, does everybody here know what Ragnarok is? If you know, it's okay. Well, these days, most people do, but for those who don't know it, in the Norse myths, unlike most mythologies, there comes a time essentially, it'd be an apocalypse where the enemies of the gods and the gods themselves all get together in a great battle plane. They all destroy each other. The world sinks into the ocean. The stars fall from the sky. Everything burns. And then ultimately, the earth is reborn and things kind of start up again. But all the gods and their enemies are all dead. The story I'm telling is kind of that story in that there's been a big battle and all the gods are dead. The trick is that Thor, who was the most powerful of the warrior gods of the Norse myths, was not present at the battle planet Vigrid. He was not present at the final battle. As a result, the Midgard serpent survived. That's the character that Thor, the beast that Thor kills in the classic stories. And as a result, the Midgard serpent survives, helps all of the other enemies kill the gods. So in the end, the Ragnarok I talk about is one in which the great enemies have won and the gods are all dead. Hundreds of years go by. Thor returns. I don't want to spoil too much. If you haven't read the comic, I hate to spoil any of it, but he comes back without knowing what had happened. But he's not a dumb guy, and he figures it out pretty rapidly. And then, knowing that all the enemies have survived, or most of them, and that his father is dead, his mother is dead, his brothers are all dead, his sisters are dead, all the people he knew, all the gods he knew. He's not happy about that. And so, as the great warrior god of the Norse myths, he picks up his hammer and goes out into what's left of the nine worlds to find all the enemies and reproved them severely. So that's my story. The first six issues are really this tale and the introduction, the ones I finished. And the ones that are coming out in the book that you see on that screen are the ones, there it is. Well, look at that, wow. That's a collection of the first six stories, first six issues, and that collects that tale. At the end of this tale, at the end of that book, more or less, Thor is about set to go out. I have a second series of stories I'm about to tell, six issues. In this book, in these stories, I introduce a black elf assassin and his daughter and his wife. I won't say more about that, I don't want to give too much away, other than the second set of issues, for those of you who have seen it, are really the story of the black elf, his daughter, Thor, and the Lord of the Dead. There has been a changing of the order of many things with the coming and going of Ragnarok. And apparently, although we have a long way to go, Hela is no longer in charge of Hel. Or if she is, her presence has disappeared. Her presence has evaporated. So there is a self-styled Lord of the Dead. He also is related to some of the old stories of Norse mythology. And he is aware, as most of the other enemies are not, he has learned that Thor is still alive. And he has taken steps to correct that. Exactly how those steps worked out is part of the story in that book. And then the consequences of those actions are the stories of the second book, which will start coming out December thereabouts. So I hope to tell this story for some time. I'd like you all to buy copies. I've got about 5 years of stories I want to do. But I do have a long-running plan with a complete story by the time I'm done, which I hope to be able to tell. And that's the story of Ragnarok.
And if you haven't seen it, let me throw out a couple of notes. In addition to Walter's great writing, storytelling, and art, the book is colored incomparably by Laura Martin and lettered by John Workman, both of whom are really adding, as great colorists and great letterers do, adding significant value to the overall package. And the hardcover is based on the PDF that I've seen is gorgeous, and it's a long way from PDF to the great print production that we're typically known for.
And I'm
a little too cocky. I apologize. We are known for good print production.
I think so. So I have a job for all of you. You need to go into your local comic shop, and we had an incentive program with this book, and what it was for every 10 copies a store ordered, Walter would do a full sketch in an additional limited edition. And some stores woefully underordered this product, and so you should go into your store, and if they don't have one of those, you should tell them they're bums, and there's still time to FOC it, and they need to pick one of those up. Because, I mean, the man threw his back out doing these sketches. He used to be rewarded for this stuff.
That was it.
Yeah. Do we have any questions for Walter? Any before we move on to the other stuff, just so we can let him get some rest, perhaps?
Am I done?
Hannah's got one.
Put your hand down. I'm done. I'm done out here.
I'm just curious as to how you see your own characterization of Thor in comparison to other people across
time.
How soon yours is?
I think, the characters aren't divorced from the world in which they live. Those are all part of the same. The idea maybe for me is that everything's part of one larger whole. And in Ragnarok, I hate to kind of do this because really, everybody was into Grimm comics 20 years ago. As usual, I'm kind of behind the curve on some stuff. So everybody was getting into, Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen and Grimm comics. And now, of course, comics are full of goodness and light and happy, and we all know how wonderfully delightful mainstream comics are. So, in the book, because of the nature of the stories I'm telling, which is a world in which my characters had his parents, his brothers and sisters, and essentially the world he knew destroyed. One thing I'll add to it, you haven't learned this much in the graphic novel in this collection. You will learn it later. I'm not giving too much away. Because the gods are dead and the enemies survive, the nine worlds themselves are out of balance, I borrow a term from Michael Moorcock. And because they're out of balance, what's happened is the nine worlds have collapsed and collided into one vast landscape. So it's called the Dusklands. And it contains all that's left of the nine, which is going to be enormous. It's gigantic. It's huge. But it's all that's left of the nine worlds. And an exemplar of that, I think sort of a an example of where the character is different. It's a dusk world. I don't want to use the word Twilight because that's a very famous other bunch of books, so I don't say Twilight. But in it, in the Norse myths originally, before Ragnarok, the sun and the moon were pursued by giant wolves forever. And but then when Ragnarok happened, the wolves finally caught the sun and the moon, the chariots that were carrying the sun and the moon, and consumed them. In the poetry and in the stories of the Norse myths, that's the end of that. They don't explain. It's not like comic books. You've got to explain everything. They never discuss those wolves or the sun and the moon again, which gives me a lot of extra room. So in my story, what's going to have happened, which Thor will learn probably in the second series of stories, is that the sun and the moon, the wolves died consuming the sun and the moon and fell to the ground, fell to the, into the dust lands. So now there is no active moving sun and the moon. The sun and the moon radiates its own light from inside these gigantic carcasses, rotting carcasses of dead wolves. We haven't seen them yet, but I've done a preliminary drawing of that stuff. So that's why it's the dust lands. It's just this dust light over everything. And that informs, in a sense, the character of Thor. Thor is very choleric. I mean, you could imagine, given the world he's discovered, he'd be pretty unhappy about it. So he has a certain choleric quality. He's also not a dumb guy. He has a temper. Yeah, in that respect, perhaps he has a little self-referencing in some of that. I don't get that out very often. But he tries to hold himself back. There are a couple of scenes where he's upset by things that he's discovered or learning or found out and kind of goes nuts for just a moment and sucks it back in and tries to use that then to go on. So I want a character who's not like an Einstein, but not a dumb guy, but a guy full of anger, mostly restrained, only seen once in a while, and a guy who has decided essentially that his mission is to go out and kill a very large number of things. And because there are only about three major foes in Ragnarok, in the Norse myths, is the Fenris wolf, there's the Jormungand, the world serpent, and Surtur, who is the fire demon in Muspelheim, and there are a lot of other major bad guys. So I'm creating, like the Lord of the Dead that I've done, I've created a whole series of lesser bad guys, kind of middlemen, whom Thor will be encountering, the Lord of the Dead himself. The name's already in the book. It's Angantyr, which is a name from the Norse legends more than the myths, who had a cursed sword, which begins to play some part in the tales I have yet to tell. So Thor's character will essentially be defined by the world in which he finds himself, by the guys he goes up against, and by what he perceives, in a sense, to be his purpose in life in this world that's really completely full of death. One short example, Hell is also broken. We haven't seen it yet. That will not be showing up. Probably at least the third story arc. But the world Thor finds is full of what would be the Norse zombies, if you want to call them that. They're called Draugr, Draugr. And so there are a bunch of these guys walking around. They're also the Nair. I don't know, maybe that's not the right pronunciation. It's N-A-I-R with an accent. They go to the A. And those are the oath breakers and adulterers and murderers who are the worst of the Norse crimes, who are down in the deepest part of hell. And apparently they've gotten out, or some of them have gotten out as well. So some of the world's inhabited by these guys walking around. And Thor is still, as he is in the Norse myths, given toward protecting mortals. The world that I envision in this is kind of a medieval world, full of lords and serfs and kingdoms and different guys, mostly non-human, have carved out of this, of the Dusklands themselves. And Thor, I wouldn't say his main purpose is not to go set this to rights, but those that he meets who need help, he's immortals. He's inclined to help. Mortals are mostly serfs or slaves. There will be some small communities that there have survived and become their own place. I see a lot of the world as agrarian, not full of a lot of fancy machinery. Although the dwarves, because bless their hearts, they're very smart little guys, have invented something called the Verger gates. Verger is the Norse word for dwarf, and they're really teleportation gates. I've got a giant world. I don't want Thor to spend half my comic book galloping across the landscape, as fabulous as my landscape would be if I drew all of it. And so there are these gates that if you have gold, because my dwarves, like many dwarves in many other stories, are interested in monetary gain. If you have the gold, you can enter the gate and come out at some other gate somewhere else in the world. And so I have stuff like that that I'm beginning to introduce as I go along, that Thor himself in this first book encounters when he has to use one of the gates. And initially, when the dwarves see him, Thor has no lower jaw. Now, a troll does in fact ask him how he manages to talk. And he does say, it's a trick. That's all I really said about that. But Thor goes up, the dwarves see him, they try to shoot him with a crossbow. He deflects the quarrel and explains to these children of Earth that they should not do that again. And then because they've tried to kill him, he figures he's due for a free pass through the gate. And the dwarves are game to do that. And then Thor explains a little further that if they give him a free pass, and he ends up in some godforsaken part of the Dusklands, a billion miles from nowhere, he will eventually come back. And when he comes back to this gate, he and the dwarves will discuss the manner of their transportation. And the dwarves decide, let me just refit my controls here for a minute, just to make sure I've got this correct. And which Thor thinks is kind of funny. And as a result, Thor tosses him a small bit of elvish gold he actually was carrying, but hadn't used. So there's stuff like, I want a character with some humor behind him. I want him with a great depth of knowledge about war and fighting. I want him with quick anger. I also want him with, and this is in the second issue, which I won't tell you what the actual incident was, an appreciation of courage. As a warrior himself, he understands what courage is about and admires it in others, no matter who they are, friend or foe. That's probably as much as I can tell you about the character right now, boring you're going out and reading the comic book. So,
a lighthearted romp.
It's a lighthearted romp for a world of dead guys. That's kind of the book.
That's exactly right.
So just one quick note. The hardcover is not yet available. I mentioned, I think, November. But we did in time for the show, literally, they were air flown in. We have a beautiful portfolio of some of all 12, actually, of Walter's covers for the first six issues. So, and that's just, if you like original art or if you like art just period, these are just a beautiful portfolio that's available.
Came out nice one.
Mm-hmm. Those are exclusive to the show, and then Walter will be signing again tomorrow, unless my back,
I could be on the road home tomorrow. Yeah. My back is really cranky.
Just use the dwarves' gate to get there.
I wish.
And one more shameless plug for Walter specifically. Tomorrow at 11 o'clock, we have a panel here that will really just be talking to Walter about, obviously, we'll be talking a little bit about Ragnarok, but a lot about his art that he's created, as well as art that he loves by others, and his thinking about collecting art for himself. And that should be a really interesting hour. So
I'm hoping the light going out there will not have an omen how that panel is going to go.
Right. It just means we can see the art at a better angle.
That's correct.
That's right.
All right.
Those are two of the covers.
Any other questions for Mr. Simonson before we let him go?
Yes, sir. You mentioned that you had the inception of this idea was like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Did you fully form it and then kind of shelve it at that point?
What happened 15 years ago, Scott called me and asked me, you want to do a book? I said, yeah, sure, but I'm kind of busy. I'll get back to you.
All right.
13 years later, because it was before this, there were a couple of them were up there. I did a couple of drawings of Thor, of a version of Thor, my own version, that shot right there on the left, just really for fun. It's not a pure Norse costume. I kind of borrow from different things. The leggings are more Japanese, honestly. But I did a couple of drawings of that character, really just for fun. And then I put it aside, didn't think about it, except I did think about it. One of my friends who makes t-shirts made a t-shirt out of that drawing, which might not be available anymore, I'm not sure. But I thought about the drawing, and I began thinking, what is the story with this guy? Because if I was just the Norse myths, you can buy the book about the Norse myths, any book in the Norse myths, and read some cool stories. And the idea when you do these, something like this, is you'd like to do something that's not quite the same. I don't want you guys to read the stories knowing what's going to happen. So I thought about it, and I came up with the idea. I came up with an idea for finding Thor in a certain location. That would spoil some of the beginning of the first volume. But I had an idea for what I thought was a great beginning for a story. And that's all I really had. I had no idea what was going to happen when Thor emerged from this part of the story. I didn't have any thoughts about a story. And so a year later, I was driving on a road near my home. I was heading, this is how long ago this was, Borders was still in existence back then.
Oh, man.
So I know. We had a great board, isn't there? I was crushed when they went out of business. I was driving from getting a slice of pizza to going over to board, and I could use more books. And as I'm about halfway there, suddenly, I mean, it was like one of the only two instances I know of where I had a light bulb go off in my head, and I knew what the world was. I knew it was a post-Ragnarok world, which I did not know before. And I was extremely pissed, because I began thinking about it and going, and then I turned the damn car around and go back to my house and start typing. Because I have learned the hard way, this is a lesson for all you would-be and real writers, I'm sure, that if I have a brilliant idea, I can't say, this is so brilliant, there's no way I'm going to forget it. So I'm going to go ahead and go get my slice of pizza and run over to do here, go to border, do whatever I'm going to. I'll get home and I'm thinking, oh, crap. I had this great idea. It had something to do with paper clips and sugar cones. And that's all I remember. It's so annoying. And so I knew I had to turn around and go back and write. So I wrote for an hour before my wife got home. By the time I finished the hour, I had the basic outline of what this Dusklands were like. The idea that, you know, the sun and the moon collapsed and all sorts of other stuff. Not the whole story for the character, but it told me the world he inhabited. And that gave me, kind of like I mentioned earlier, the character, that gave me a place to start, or from this start, to go somewhere that began to develop into what's become Ragnarok. And once I had enough of that stuff hammered together, I got a hold of Scott and said, here's my idea.
Did you say that's hammered together? I just want to double check.
What's that?
Did you just say hammered together? That was
maybe. I don't usually make puns deliberately. It just comes out.
That was good.
Me and Yogi Bear were like that.
All right.
So that was it.
I'm glad you turned your car around.
Me too.
Me too. Well said.
All right.
Should we let this man go
I
get
think
some
that's
rest?
Probably
all right.
Thank you all. I would say
you're the toughest man in comics, as we said.
Once I walk a few feet, it loosens up.
Thank you, Walter. And if that didn't make you want to buy the book,
all right. Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
Thanks, Walter.
Thanks.
And he'll be back on stage tomorrow with Greg, talking to him about all sorts of classic art. So, yeah.
More motion.
You can do it.
I got better stuff.
All right. There you go. Let's see. That's what the president's for.
Ladies and gentlemen, drug supplier.
All right. Shall we talk to James?
Oh, boy.
We should. All right. Can I do a little quick intro on sort of Turtles, Batman, and Star Trek, Green Lantern, and just sort of the whole
sure.
thing? So we've had a really great relationship with our friends in the comic book industry, and if you look carefully enough, you'll notice that we've published things by Marvel, DC, Archie, EC. A couple of projects that you might normally associate with Dark Horse have landed at IDW. A couple of things you might think of should normally be at Image. I mean, we're really finding interesting niches and ways to work with technically our competitors. We don't really think of them this way. We think that all these projects kind of help the industry as a whole. And so I'm particularly proud of being able to do some of these DC crossovers, because we will brainstorm internally all the time and say, you know, do our own sort of what ifs and come up with ideas, some of which are so far reaching they're never going to happen, and some of which are great ideas that just take the right time. And the most two recent ones, Star Trek Green Lantern and Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, are perfect examples of waiting for the right time. And I'm so excited that this is happening. I'm so excited that you're doing this. And take it away.
Yeah. All right. I think I was at C2E2 this year when Jim Chadwick shot me the email that was just like, is this something you would be at all interested in? And I was just like, are you kidding me? This is, you know, the definition of a fanboy dream. Like, this is a, you know, it's taking two of the most iconic, amazing properties that I have loved my entire life and bringing them together for the first time. Like, these are two properties that have never interacted with each other before. And, you know, look at that. It's just absolutely incredible to see these characters come together. The story is basically going to take the Turtles into New York, into Gotham City from New York, and take place in the DC Universe, but the Turtles did not come alone. We are going to see Shredder and the entire Foot Clan along for the ride. And this is going, like, things are going to get very dangerous in Gotham very quickly. And Batman and the Turtles are going to have to come together and understand who each other are and in order to, you know, stop everything that Shredder has planned and also make sure that they can all get home. It's just an absolutely fun project to work on. I just finished the second script earlier this week, and I'm seeing the pages come in on the first one right now. I'm working with the amazing Freddie Williams, and his work is just absolutely phenomenal. And he works in a very, like, interesting way with very, like, there are very defined stages of, like, wireframes and stuff like that, and it's just, like, it's fascinating to watch. It's at, like, every single stage is, like, a full production, and his emails kind of talk it all through, and I'm like, ooh, this is fascinating, every single time. It's just, like, the first time I actually got to put words in the Turtles' mounts. The only thing comparable is the first time I got to write Batman at DC Comics, because there's something, you know, there's something almost sacred to the characters that you grew up with and love, and especially characters that are so storied and have so many different incarnations. I've talked a lot in terms of Batman about how there's a core voice of Batman, like the true voice of Batman, and every writer is trying to get to the true voice, and the true voice changes in time because every new thing sort of changes the center of the plot, and that's also true of the Turtles, where you're trying to get at an iconic core, and it's really fascinating, and it was really, really powerful to just sit down with them and really feel them come to life. Like, it's more than channeled through me, and it's something really, really special. And yeah,
was a pretty nat. Those two voices that are very both iconic, as you
right.
said, but very distinct.
Yeah,
were there challenges in having a mesh in any sort of way, or was it a natural?
It's been pretty natural. To be fair, I'm at the part of the story where they're still sort of clashing rather than, you know, working side by side. So there's less of the sit down and have a chat scene.
Sit down and have a pizza.
That
better be early on.
Oh, God.
I mean, I'm counting.
Oh, there are pizzas in every issue. that is not a joke.
Spoiler alert.
pizza's an important part.
I just want to see. I'm telling you, when the first time that when this finally became greenlit, I said out loud, I said to no one in particular, okay, I just want to see Bruce Wayne having a pizza. This is just something.
I have a moment that I have not written yet, but I knew it was also a moment like that came to me where it's the moment right before that moment. It's Alfred just really upset accepting a stack of pizzas at the door of Wayne Manor. He could have made like the best gourmet pizza in the world, but no, they're getting delivery. And
just love that. And those of you that don't know Freddie Williams is the third guy.
Third and a fourth.
I'm detecting a pattern here. I just realized that. But those of you that don't know Freddie, it's really interesting because he is such a perfect choice for this. Because honestly, he's done some DC superhero stuff that's really wonderful. But if we were looking for a new artist for Turtles, he'd be a guy in a minute. I'd be like, hey, can we get Freddie Williams? Because it's like, what a great choice for both.
Honestly. Yeah.
Really good stuff.
Yeah. It's funny, but probably the biggest fan of this project I know is Kevin Eastman. He's a huge fan of this. He's doing the variant covers, of course, for that as well, which you can kind of see up there.
Yeah.
The angle is actually a little better now, I think.
Maybe so. This has actually been something he's wanted to see happen for years, I know. It's like, there's something that just makes sense about, you know, Batman and the Turtles slinking down an alley with, manholes going off, you know, I mean, right.
Yeah.
Here's a spoiler teaser comment of the show. There are two other crossovers that Kevin would like to do. I put them both on my Mission Impossible list, but we're going to get them done sooner or later. It's the last thing I do.
They're not going to say what they are.
Not a chance.
But they would be great.
They would be just as good, maybe. This is going to be great. What? This is going to be great.
So this is unusual for us, obviously, because DC is actually soliciting these books, and DC is putting them
out, but working with us and everything's running.
Yeah.
Everything we see just kind of popping across the server looks fantastic.
And these two projects, you know, just sort of referencing Star Trek Green Lantern, which I think issue 4 is about to go live, or maybe it's only 3. I'm losing track. We print in Korea, so we see our advances very early sometimes, and it confuses me about the street day. But anyway, this has been, of all the crossovers we've done, they've all been great, they've all been fun. This is, you know, it's been a cooperative editorial effort and marketing effort from the whole team, and really, you know, with a lot of the same people sort of all pulling together to make these things really interesting. So I'm excited. There's a couple of good Batman things happening, but this is one I'm really excited about.
Yeah. And you know what DC's excited about it, from the people I've talked to over there. And they've got plenty going on, too. They're all like, this is cool, you know.
Yeah, actually, I was with Dan yesterday, and we were talking about it. He loved it. He's really excited.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, so we've got a few other things to talk about, but we could go ahead if anybody has any questions for James, if you want to questions for us.
However you want to do it.
Sure.
I don't know if you can talk on this or not, but with Turtles and Batman, do either of them, going into the first issue, do either of them know the existence of each other, or is it a straight, a surprise for both of them?
It's a surprise.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Like, it was actually one of the first emails I sent was the, okay, what are the rules?
Right.
Because you have to lay those down. And even getting into like the really, really weird versions where it's just like, are the fictional versions of both of them, do they exist in the each universe? Does Mikey read Batman comics? And does, did Batman, because now if you actually look at the age of Batman with the sliding timeline, he could have grown up watching Turtles. And while that would be fun, I feel like that'd be fun in a kind of like, this is an interesting scene, but it causes a lot of problems. it's kind of, you know, they are not aware of the existence of each other. They're from different universes, because that's the other version you can do. You could do the version where the Turtles have kind of always existed in New York City, and they're just visiting Gotham, but they just never mention each other ever again. There are lots of ways to do a crossover, but we're doing, you know, Turtles, thankfully, in their mythology have beings from other dimensions, so hopping dimensions isn't too far outside the realm of possibility.
For the sequel, you just roll Back to the Future in there, send them back to Batman 66.
I like it.
There we go.
Batman 66 beats the cartoon Turtles. You heard it here first. Why don't we? We do have a bunch of other stuff. We'll open the questions up all over to whatever.
Yeah. So let's talk about a few other things. As you know, we do a few books at IDW. The Rocketeer. So the Rocket. Any fans of the Rocketeer out there? The late, great, amazing Dave Stevens. Greg, you want to talk about the new series?
So this is really exciting. We've been quiet on the Rocketeer front for I want to say a couple years now, and we really wanted to get the right creative team. Scott Dunbeer, who's the editor, and I had an artist in mind, and really there were a couple of pitches that came in from writers that just weren't, it just didn't capture the spirit of the Rocketeer in the way that we wanted to. And then Scott talked to Mark Guggenheim, who's got obviously great comics experience, but also working in TV, really has, you know, sort of really has a very imaginative way of looking at the bigger picture, no pun intended. And Mark came in with a proposal that's really great, and Dave, who's been anxious to draw the Rocketeer for years at this point now, have come together for Rocketeer at War, launching in December. It's a 4-issue mini. I've seen some of the initial art. It looks great. It'll actually be at New York Comic Con. There'll be a wonderful print of,
there it is.
From issue 2. And again, you can even see in the design of that, which Dave did, of that poster, you know, capturing that that retro feel from the era and making sure it really fully respects what Dave was trying to accomplish with Rocketeer. A lot of fun. He's here at the show. I actually chatted with him for a few minutes earlier, and he couldn't be more excited. So we're looking forward to that. Mm-hmm.
Next up, let's see. This is the evil version of Archie. We don't need to elaborate on that much.
got yourself into a lot of slideshows.
I didn't mean to on this one, actually. But that opens up to Archie month. So our friends at Archie have graciously allowed us to do some variant covers in December. So we're doing a whole series of Archie-themed variant covers. I wish you could see those a little closer, but if you hop on any number of our fabulous websites, maybe even Bleeding Cool. They did. There you go.
Thank you.
We've got a great, and it's great. It sort of touches on all different eras of Archie, but we got Captain Pureheart in there. You've got, I mean, it's great.
Yeah, it's really in capturing the spirit of Archie. And I don't recall if you said, but the celebration in December is really ahead of Archie's 75th anniversary, which is next year. And really, it's a, you know, Archie's a pop culture icon, and we talk. The buzzword in the industry lately is diversity, and I remind people that, you know, Archie was making girl-friendly comics, and they were the only ones in some cases. I mean, obviously, there were some other things going on in a minor way. That was outside. No, nobody complaining about my Archie comic. Jeez, it's Archie. But in any event, you know, they're an important pop culture icon, and they're one of those, you know, if you went to a mall and you showed a handful of people just images of characters, you know, Batman, Turtles, Superman, Spider-Man, they're going to be able to identify those characters. And Archie and the gang, especially if you show the sort of group together, people are going to know. So this is just a fun way of saying, hey, you know, happy birthday, Archie, and let's have some fun with this. And most of the licensors we approached, you know, themselves are Archie fans, and they got on board.
Well, that's one thing we're good at. I mean, if you know, it's not entirely uncomplicated to convince Star Trek and CBS Paramount that it's a good idea to have Archie on their cover. It takes them, you know. But the good thing of all these licensors and all these creators, everybody we've worked with, eventually they learn to trust us when we do some kind of wacky stuff and it turns out well and gets a lot of attention on these books. They're more inclined to sort of be like, okay, we don't know what you're talking about, but you guys know what you're doing, let it rip.
Yeah, you can't see, it's covered. I mean, they're all covered a little bit. The X-Files cover is great because it's the modern Sabrina. It's the sort of, you know, it's their... They're scary, dark Sabrina mixed in with our X-Files. I mean, they're just great stuff.
Yeah, creative, good stuff. Just the aforementioned Turtles is hitting issue 50. So anybody reading our ongoing Turtle series? It's been hugely successful. We're really excited about it. And if you notice in the marketplace out there, there are not a ton of comic books hitting the 50th issue anymore. And I understand why that is. The marketplace has changed there. We certainly have done plenty of relaunches in our day, but it's really gratifying to have our comics hit that number and keep going with no sign of stopping. We're actually selling more copies of Turtles at issue 50 than we were at issue 30, you know, which is unusual in this day and age, and it is a testament to what those guys are doing.
So it's an unbelievable team, and the editorial team on Turtles is just so strong. Kevin is an integral part. He's been involved in plotting or writing all 50 of the issues. This is the first time in history, over 30 years of Turtles, that there's been a monthly Turtles book that's hit, you know, every time. And you know, he's really had a chance with this schedule to sort of develop ideas and characters and storylines that have just, you know, that were just pipe dreams for him. You know, and took a while to sort of get going. And his collaborators, Tom Waltz on writing and Bobby Curnow on editing. They're three of a kind, and they're really creative, really creative folks.
And the artists they're working with are fantastic. They work with a guy, Matteo Santoloco, if you guys have read some recent issues. And actually, in our booth, we have a limited print that there were six connecting covers that he did that make this mosaic that's incredible. You got to check it out. That's a show exclusive. It's $10. Also, Star Trek's hitting issue number 50. And just in time for the 50th anniversary of Star Trek next year. So there's going to be a lot of exciting Star Trek stuff coming, including Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, and this is one that I'm really looking forward to, because those of you that are Star Trek fans, particularly of the reboot, the J.J. Abrams 2009 movie, there's a really big gap between them going into Starfleet and them going off on the mission terms of trying to save the world or the universe from destruction. And this really deals with their time in the academy, that they need to learn about what it's like to be officers. And it's just got a nice, I mean, you can just tell by the cover art, it's just got a nice feel, it's fresh, it's young, it's got a real very nice entry-level point for Star Trek.
Yeah, it's a YA sort of focused book. Derek Charm's doing the art, who's known for a pretty cartoony style, but has sort of developed a new style he's doing with these. And they've actually, for the first time in a while, they've allowed him to design new races. And so several of the characters that are in there, they're sort of mixing the current, you know, crew in there with some new characters that he's been allowed to design. It's pretty cool.
Right.
So another thing, in issue 50, there are both of our ongoing Transformers books, but we are also putting out a miniseries called Sins of the Wreckers. Anybody remember it was Transformers Last Stand of the Wreckers a few years ago that Nick Roche did? This is essentially the sequel. So we're excited about that one. What else? We do too many books, as you can tell. We got a lot to cover here. Back to the Future. Hopefully everybody knows we're doing Back to the Future coming up. And I don't know if you've noticed, but October 21st, 2015 is the date that Marty McFly traveled to in the future with the hoverboards and everything. That's coming up, about a month. And happens to be a Wednesday, and happens to be the day that the first comic is coming out. And so shops all over the country are doing, it's pretty awesome. We planned it that way 5 years ago when we started talking about this license. So let's hold off for 5 years and do it on that, one.
I told this story yesterday to the retailers. I'll share it with you guys. We there are certain properties and certain things that we have a passion for. Either we personally, internally have a passion for, or creators that we work with have a passion for. And shortly after we saw success with Ghostbusters, this was an obvious sort of addition to the line that we really wanted to pursue. Universal Amblin just wasn't ready at the time, and I would meet with them. I've been friends with them for years. I'd meet with them every few months, and I just kind of nudge them a little bit about Back to the Future and say, you know, guys. And then last year I started hitting the panic button. If there is such a thing with the studios. I said, 2015 October. You know, I'm driving up to WonderCon this year, and I get the call, and she's and our contact over there, a very lovely woman. Running that department forever, said, okay, you can do it. I said, thanks. I hung up the phone and I called the office and I said, we gotta move. We don't have any time. If you know WonderCon's the end of March, when you think of long lead time of getting stories approved and writing and art and all those other great things, we were out of time. I really could have used a little bit of a time machine at that point. But we pulled together a great series with Bob Gale, the writer of the movie. This is really his brainchild in terms of the editorial direction we've taken. Much like a situation with Turtles where you have the original creator involved, but you know, this is Bob going into the DeLorean with us.
Very well said.
Thank you.
Because we're excited about that one. And it's a pretty good segue, because one of the things that made us interested in pursuing Back to the Future was the success of Ghostbusters, and we are kind of looking for things in that niche. What's one thing we're pretty good at is media, properties from that era, and most importantly, like James here, finding creators that are as big of fans as anyone else on these properties. And the Ghostbusters guys, I mean, if you've read any of these books, if you've watched the movies, I met a guy the other day, he's a retailer, maybe he's here, nice guy, said he watches Ghostbusters 1 and 2 once a week.
Wow.
It's true. We've all got hobbies.
Was he married?
Unclear. But at any rate, he loved the comics because these guys, I mean, I don't know if they're watching once a week, but probably close, because they find Easter eggs that are hidden in there from toys that nobody saw 25 years ago, and they just jam them in there. And it's just, I think that's what makes these books successful. If you get someone that's that, A, they're talented, B, they're a giant fan, that's a recipe for success.
Yeah, and one without the other is a little tougher on these licensed properties. We've had very talented creators who liked a property but didn't have that special passion, and it doesn't, I'm sad to say, because I like to think all our things work, it doesn't work. And after the fact, I can even tell, that the market figures it out, because they're the trades that don't sell as well as some of the other ones. And the flip side, of course, is true. Just because you're passionate, if you don't have the imagination or ability to execute on that passion and turn it into something that makes everyone happy, that's also a challenge. But we're blessed. So many wonderful licensed properties, as you can see by going through the slideshow, and so many great creative teams working on them.
All right, we've got a few more things to jam through, and we've got about 17 minutes left, so let's power through these videos. We can hopefully take a few questions. But one, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. from our friends at Top Shelf, who we're so happy are part of the IDW family now. I'm not going to show it to you, but I have a Hunter Thompson tattoo from about 24 years ago. So, and it's, it would make you not buy the book if you saw it, so I won't show it to you. But it is fantastic. I believe we've got some interior pages here that from Troy Little. We were all a little nervous about this book. And by the way, there's some free preview books down at our booth if you want to check it out. But we were nervous about it because it's such an iconic book, obviously, and is so associated with Ralph Steadman's art that we didn't want to ape that style, but you didn't want to run from it completely. And Troy just found this style that has just knocked it out of the park. It looks fantastic. So check that out. It's coming out in October. Empire, I wanted to throw this up here. They couldn't be here, but Mark Wade and Barry Kitson are here at the show, and they're doing Empire with us, which, you know, it came out, it's been several years now since it started being published digitally. And we've collected the original ones and have a new series coming, Uprising, which has been coming out and doing great. So I encourage you to check out Empire. Let's hear Mark and Barry at the show.
Oh, we're really glad to bring this thing back because, honestly, I think at this point it was more than a dozen years old, but I think before the collection had been out of print, and just the fact that I heard those guys wanted to do new stories sort of stopped me in my tracks and said, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you were going to say something?
James? Well, that comes out of the Thrill Bend comics thing, and I actually, you guys are publishing The Eighth Seal, another Thrill Bend project that'll be coming out to print for the first time starting in December. So, we've got like a bunch of, like the original art's by Jeremy Rock, who's absolutely incredible, and we have some amazing people coming in for the covers on there. We've got Travel Foreman, we've got Ming Doyle, like we got more that I can't talk about just yet, but it's just like it's amazing to see this property, which is actually my first ever creator-owned property. This is my original non-superhero project, and it's really, really special to see it finally come to life in print.
That's fantastic, and that's kind of a sneak peek because we haven't really gone wide with that news yet. So we will.
It's out there.
We
haven't gone wide.
Oh, okay.
But good segue. All right, and apparently there's a movie coming out in December. But these are our artist editions. We were talking about this a little bit before the panel even started. But really quickly there. You want to talk about the artist edition format of Star Wars?
But I missed the transition from before the panel started. But in any event, at this point, you're probably somewhat familiar with our artist editions. Hardcover books, reproducing the original art at the exact size it was created in full color, so you get to see all the blue lines, you get to see all the whiteout, the corrections, the paste up, the coffee stains, the oil stains, etc., etc. Star Wars are really something that I've been involved with over the years in different projects and have really wanted to do this. I'm going to use every opportunity I can to thank our friends at Marvel and Lucas for giving us the opportunity to publish this. It will be the first of at least two and possibly three Star Wars artist editions. This contains material only from the first 10 issues, and the majority of that is from the adaptation of the original movie from issues 1-6 by Howard Chaykin. Tom Palmer and others worked on it. Many hands, as one of the expressions back in the day at Marvel, meaning a whole bunch of people helped to get the book out on time. And so this will be great. And then next year, we're going to have Al Williamson's work on Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, and potentially a third volume of later stuff coming down the pipe. So that's exciting.
Speaking of formats of Star Wars.
And you can have now the biggest Star Wars book you've ever owned in terms of square footage, and now you can have the smallest book you'll ever own in Star Wars Micro Fun Packs, or in this case, the Micro Comic Collector's Packs. Those of you that have seen those are comics at about 3x5 or a little bit bigger size. These come blind packed, all six again of the original Star Wars movie adaptation, so the six total different issues. Six 3D posters of the covers that come with nice, cool 3D glasses, and 36 comic cards, which are panels from the comics themselves to collect. They'll be in a box that looks similar to a trading card type box. And if your retailer forgot to order them, just like Ragnarok and a handful of other things, just go nudge them.
Right.
And last but not least, we've been doing a number of different board games in the last couple of years. Anybody played any of our board games?
Two board games, right?
Yeah. We did a game called Machi Koro that people are just freaking out about. If you're a board game enthusiast, I encourage you to find it. It's a great family game. We have modest expectations. We sold like 180,000 of these games or something crazy like that. So people are really loving that. And
it's really designed, and when we say family friendly, it's a non-genre game. So it's just basically, you know, it's the kind of game, if your comic book store caters to other people than just sort of hardcore comic book collectors, you know, it's great because families come in and they're like, well, what do I do here?
And that's the end of our official stuff. So we got about 10 minutes left for questions.
Q&A.
Or angry comments or whatever you'd like. Yes, sir.
We only have 10 seconds left.
I was
going
to say, I was in San Diego.
Oh, yeah, you know what? We didn't put that in here, but we did make two big announcements at San Diego. Micronauts.